Speaking of reliability. Friends talking about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. My name is Chris Jackson.
And this is Fred Schenkelberg, and thanks for joining us. I'm going to dive right into this one, Chris. We just finished recording an episode about the Soyuz rocket, which will probably be out just before this episode. So if you want to get our take on what's going on with that in the news, listen to the previous episode. But out of that discussion, one of the things you mentioned, Chris, is something that I know I say it quite often, is failures are gold. They are to be celebrated. Why is that not more prevalent? Why do I've run into team after team that we only test to success. We only, if we have a failure, the marketing team doesn't like it. We can't use that data. And it's kind of I think they're missing the point of the development process and testing and evaluations and field failures coming back to the organization, the value that's in them. And what's your experience with this?
I think it's a combination of leadership, enlightenment or awareness, mm-hmm. and psychology. You have leaders that, for whatever reason, they don't want to see failure. And if leaders don't want to see something, then their team
won't show it to them. They won't. They're like, if it's not safe to say, oh, this prototype failed and I don't know what the solution is, and it's likely to delay the program a month, that could be bad news. And it's that phenomena of shoot the messenger kind of thing that occurs some places. Is that what you're?
Absolutely. I mean, it's just, and those leaders, those managers, or whatever leadership role they play, they tend to be, it's a psychological and an awareness issue as well. If they know anything about developing a new system, they know that you want it to fail in a laboratory and not when it's being used by a customer, first and foremost. Yeah. And they should know that you only get that sort of failure information from observing actual failures.
Well, there's a lot of pressure, though, for time to market or hit cost targets or to – I love the organizations. And it's been big in the MBA world is that 20% of your products have to be innovative in your portfolio every year. And that's a huge demand on a development team that you're scheduling inventions over and over again. And that doesn't always necessitate having time to deal with failures.
That's true. I mean, I do think, I know what you're saying. There's always this competitive tension between getting the perfect product out to market and getting the product out to market on time for it to be relevant. There's competing interests. And there's a saying, give me an 80% solution now, not 100% solution when it's too late.
Well, there's a balance there, right? It's
absolutely,
you know, I've been accused of this too, is if I let you work on this, you'll work on it forever and we'll never get a product out to market. And then mm-hmm. I can't generate revenue to pay your paycheck or pay the lab fees or whatever. So it's, I understand that. Yet, I think it's more subtle that pressure can go either I expect failures and we're gonna handle them and they're useful, or failures are an obstacle we just have to get over. And it's a different approach. And I think that's what you're talking about with the psychology part. It sets a different tone mm-hmm. in an organization.
Well, some people can't deal with risk. Psychologically, they can't deal. It has to be perfect. And if they have this idea of perfect, if things have to be perfect, because they never are, then what's your response? Is you bury your head in the sand.
Yeah, yeah.
So you didn't know that it wasn't perfect, so it still could be perfect. And that's not useful. But I think that with that, those organizations which balance that competitive tension between risk of failure and time to market, it's an informed risk. They know if it's going to fail, it's going to fail like this. And they've done some rudimentary things through you know, design margins or just over-engineering from the start to accommodate that. I sense you know what I'm talking about. You walk into those organizations who will say, yes, I know it's not perfect yet. We think it's going to fail like this, and here's what we're doing to mitigate it in a very high-level agricultural way. But it's still an informed risk, where those organizations which just don't want to even think about failure, it's very obvious to at least me when I walk in to work out which one is which.
Well, it's not that they don't want to think about failure, because their customers are going to be complaining and experiencing failures generally. And then they're running around with fire drills and emergencies, and they're very reactive. Even in the development process, if it failed the high temperature test, all hands on deck, we need to sort this out. And how'd that happen? And you got 2 days to fix it, otherwise we're not on schedule, kind of a discussion, rather than, well, why did it fail? What's the root cause here? Let's learn something from that. It still can be hectic and busy, and with an emphasis to getting back on schedule, yet it's not how do we patch this versus how do we understand this, which are completely different approaches.
Absolutely. Because of the reason why is because the managerial team who want to understand the root cause understand that by eliminating that root cause, they eliminate the other failure they're going to experience 3 weeks later. That puts the schedule or risk schedule even further.
That's right.
They understand why they're doing it. If the patch is the right solution, then the patch is the right solution. But usually it's, as you know, it's something deeper.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. I've run into a couple managers in my career that typify both scenarios is, you know, failure is not an option, right? And we have no plan B. And then I think there's even business books that talk about that you do project management that doesn't have a repair or rework cycle. It's you squeeze everything through as tight as you can to make your targets. And if there's a failure or a setback, then you start looking at it again to say, well, what do we do about that? How do we get back on track? How do we squeeze something else out of the schedule? And then there's other folks that go, you know, We're building our first prototypes, full up systems. We're locking in the design. We're going into testing, and I expect failures. Let's put something in the schedule to deal with that. I don't know what we have to fix, but if we have no time to deal with it, we'll take too many shortcuts, and we need to actually plan for failures, and be okay with that. Just the other day, I was in a review team meeting, and the senior manager is like, the engineers were a bit tentative. The management team's a little bit new, and the lead engineers were going through some of their results and says, well, 3 of the 5 tests here failed, and 2 of these failed, and some of them were real superficial failures and they could fix immediately, and others were, well, we got to figure this out. And they were very hesitant to talk about it. And then the senior manager, I think he picked up on that and goes, no, look, this is great. I expect if I didn't see any failures here, I would be suspicious that something else was happening that you guys were afraid to tell me. This is good. This is great stuff. We need to understand these failures and let's get the resources on these and sort them out and solve them. And you could just feel the sigh of relief of this team going, oh, okay, we can do this now. Sometimes it only takes a acknowledgement that a prototype failure or a test failure is okay. That's why we do these things, is to learn something. It's not just to pass them. It's not always feasible.
That's right. Oh, I mean, and as that saying, which I think you're the first one from whom I heard it, was you test to learn, you don't test to pass.
That's right.
Because if you test a pass, all you do is make you feel happier. That's the only out. It doesn't influence the design. The design hasn't changed from before it was tested to after it's tested. The only thing that happens if you test to pass is that you will feel better about it. But if you test to learn, that's different.
That's right.
You're actually going to try and make the system fail in order to understand how that happened.
That's right. And it's funny how our language can contorts us a little bit. And I think there's a little bit of the fear of statistics involved here also that's out there. Is I often hear that if we had three units and we run them in this sequence of testing and they all pass, we get more confidence that it's going to work. And I often challenge that when they use the word confidence. Are you mean statistical confidence? Do you mean that the sample is giving us assurance or information about the population? And they're like, yeah, that's what I mean. And I'm like, no, let's work out the numbers here. You've got like a 10% chance that this sample represents the population given the test we just ran. Is that what the risk you want to take? Oh, no, that's not what I mean. It makes me feel I can sleep better at night. Is then they rephrase it more of the common vernacular of confidence. And I, mm-hmm. Okay, that's great. We still haven't learned anything.
That's right.
I was like, let's go break stuff. That's where the fun happens. And that usually doesn't go anywhere either. I have to be more subtle about it.
Yeah, it's. I remember there was one scenario when I was in the military. We were trying to work out how we could validate or get confidence that a blank firing attachment could stop a round. And so, for those who don't know what a blank firing attachment is, it's a thing you screw in the end of the rifle of your barrel to essentially block off the barrel except for a tiny little hole. And you do that when you're using blank rounds, because blank rounds don't have projectiles, they just have gases. And the reason you have to have a blank firing attachment is because without it, the gas ejected from the blank round won't then be fed back into the mechanism of the rifle to recock it. So you won't have an automatic firing pattern. And the problem we were trying to solve was we want to have a blank firing attachment which is able to stop a live round if it accidentally gets inserted into our blank round stockpile. Mm-hmm. The reason why that's a massive concern is, for those of you with military backgrounds probably aware of this, you use blanks when you're firing at people in a training scenario.
You're practicing actually moving and target acquisition and it's simulated as close as you can get to real without killing your comrades.
Exactly. Yeah, so you do those blanks because they make the noise. They have a realistic feeling in your hand when you're firing them. But every now and then, a live round, a round with a bullet, will get mixed in with blank ammunition, and that's bad if you've got a rifle pointing at a role player. Mm-hmm. And there's a live round's about to go down range toward that poor unfortunate. And so they wanted to have a blank firing attachment to be screwed into the end of the rifle that was able to stop up to three live rounds. And so the test regime they came up with, and they only had a limited sample size because they got a bunch of options from different suppliers, mm-hmm. was the initial one was initial approach was, okay, let's put it on the end of a rifle and fire three live rounds and see if it works, see if it stopped all three. And that's that's actually a pass fail. Did it? Yes. No.
Yeah, it either did it or it didn't, if it didn't destroy the rifle.
Correct. But then I suggested, how about you, instead of doing it, we did some basic statistics and we worked out how many tests you'd have to do to work out whether it worked or not. Mm-hmm. And it was just not enough from a statistical interpretation of confidence. So I said, how about instead of doing that, you actually fire round after round until the blank firing attachment breaks. And the reason you do that is you get more information. So, for example, mm-hmm. if you have three blank firing attachments you're going to test and you test all three of them by firing three rounds, and yes, none of them failed, none of them let any live rounds out, versus those same three blank firing attachments, but you fire enough rounds into them until they break, and the first one took 20 rounds, the second one took 21 rounds, and the third one took 19 rounds, which test regime do you have more confidence in terms of the results?
That's right. Yeah. You get consistency of how it failed. You learn just what are the types of failures? If one would have failed at 4 rounds and the other two at 20 rounds, well, what was the difference right away?
Exactly.
Right. And, oh, we don't have that much margin on this solution, where if another vendor was all 50 rounds before they failed and they all failed consistently, I think I just learned something about the physics of these designs.
And you'd also have more confidence in the blank firing attachment, which failed after 20 rounds versus a blank firing attachment, which failed after 4 rounds. The one that failed after 20 rounds passed just as well as the one that failed after 4 rounds, based on your definition of success. It has to stop 3 rounds, but very human reactions, it got more confidence.
There's not a lot of support for the statistics of estimating the number of rounds to failure distribution yet.
That's right.
You know that you can do some more work there to say, oh, all right, given even this limited sample of times or shots to fail, we're a long way away from where our target was or our goal was. But I think it's more than just the basic math in that use of the confidence. Is we understand how it fails. We understand that it's consistent how it fails. We understand that there's margin versus the target we wanted to use, or the objective we wanted to use. Target's probably not the right word there.
Yeah, that's right.
But the same thing, I mean, the exact same logic I've used for drop testing. So many teams want to just go, all right, well, the standard for drop testing is 10 drops on these different faces from 3 feet onto a standard floor, concrete or carpet or whatever their market is. And if it survives that and still works, we call it a pass. And if it doesn't, we fail. And they'll do 3 samples or they'll do 7 samples. There's like these magic numbers they use from these various standards. And he says, well, why don't we just run it to failure and see what happens? And let's more along the lines of just what's going to fail first. What's going to happen there? How is it going to fail safe? Or is it going to fail the way we expect? Or is it going to reveal something absolutely new to us? And the same logic, though, is I only get a few samples. If I run them to failure, I get way more information and an ability to detect differences in a manufacturing line. So we ended up knowing that this one product I was working on was, its most likely failure scenario was drop, that people would drop these things or throw them against the wall or whatever. It's a handheld game controller. And we knew that impact was going to be its biggest risk. And we purposely designed it to be fairly robust. And we understood from the development work that here's how it would likely fail if we dropped it over and over and over again. And it was like 75 drops. And I had to talk everybody into it. Just keep going. Yes, this takes time. let's do this. So we did dozens of units to failure, and they were all like 75 to 100 drops before we got a functional failure out of this thing. We started production, and I said, let's make sure our production line is making the product we think it's making, and drop test is our biggest risk. So we dropped it to failure. And the first one we did failed after 4 drops. And now it was obvious that something fundamental was different in the construction of this product. And
right.
And then it was no questions asked after that. Is every week we pulled 1 or 2 units off of the line and dropped them to failure. And if they didn't go 50 plus times to be in the mix of where we designed it to, there was a problem. So if it had 30 drops and it failed, something changed and we needed to stop production and go figure it out, because we don't have as robust a product as we expected to. If we would have done just 10 drops, we would have caught the 4, but not have a real good target of what we were expecting to fail, or what was the number of failures that proves that we're still good. If we just did 10 again, we probably wouldn't have really fixed the problem.
Wouldn't even know there was a problem.
Oh, yeah. And yeah, especially if that first one that actually failed for us, if it failed at 11 cycles, we wouldn't have even detected it. And we would have merrily shipped products that would have fallen apart in customers' hands.
Mm-hmm.
And so same logic. Although it's one of the tests of all of the tests in the Mill Handbook 810. There's dozens and dozens of different environmental test there is the ballistic shock. That's the one I've not done yet.
Right.
Yeah. So
he's hoping maybe one day.
Yeah. Well, I actually got a call once from a person at one of the Army labs, and they were evaluating flak jackets, the bulletproof jackets, although they're not terribly bulletproof. They slow them down quite a bit. And I said, oh, can I come out and do that? And she goes, oh, we don't have funding for it. So it was just a phone conversation. And I was like, oh, that was so close.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I was involved in another scenario raised a point about bullet-resistant vests. And mm-hmm. another project I was working on, the vests in particular had ballistic plates, which were ultra-high molecular weight polyethylene, which is the mm-hmm. same stuff Coke bottles are made out of, mm-hmm. and it had a ceramic covering. And they wanted us to test these ballistic plates, and the reason why they had these ballistic plates in particular because they all had surface cracks in the ceramic, not big ones, just mm-hmm. hairline cracks. Mm-hmm. And as soon as they see a hairline crack, they get removed from service. And they just said, well, you know, let's just test these and see what they're all about. And they all failed miserably in terms of what they should have been doing. Mm-hmm. And so people thought, oh, okay. So if it has a crack, it's bad. You go, hey, no, let's just think about this. In fact, if you do any sort of basic research on ballistic vests and ballistic plates, you'll understand that the ceramic on the outside of most plates, all the ceramic is there to do is to deform the round so that the round, when it hits the vest, actually becomes, let's just say, fatter.
Yeah, and it slows it down. Yeah.
Slows it down, and because it becomes fatter, it has less pressure over a wider area. Mm-hmm. That's all the ceramic needs to do. And the ceramic doesn't, if the ceramic is cracked but is still where it needs to be, that's completely fine. And in fact, what they'll do when they test these plates is deliberately crack a sample plate mm-hmm. and fire around directly at that crack because it should still pass. And so all these ballistic plates, which I said, hang on, we need to have a look at this. They were failing ballistic tests. They're all cracked. That was the main differentiating feature about these plates. But they all failed. The simple, stupid conclusion was it's because of these cracks. But a simple look at the issues meant simple look at the physics of failure meant that we knew we had a problem because they were cracked. They still should work perfectly fine, but they were not doing what they needed to do. And the problem with ultra-high molecular weight polyethylene is that it's very good with chemicals. It's really, really robust, really, really stable, except if it gets heated. In fact, it doesn't take long for it to get heated to an extent where it will start to degrade in a very invisible way.
So just the storage conditions you're talking about?
Not necessarily storage conditions. It needs to be quite hot. We're talking towards, 100 degrees Celsius, relatively low in terms of melting metals, but relatively high in terms of storage conditions.
Right, right. Well, Australia gets pretty hot. I don't know about 100 degrees C. Yeah. But are you saying that as the bullet enters, that it heats it up quick enough to change property? No? Okay. In between. Okay. I'm guessing here.
Absolutely. And we still don't know exactly what caused it. But one of the issues, what we do know, that the soldiers aren't aware of this. And so, for example, in artillery regiments, you'll have soldiers using their ballistic plates, which are on their back, to lean against the hot barrel of an artillery piece just to take a break.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because it's, they're very, very insulating as well. Exactly. So we have, and if you can imagine ballistic plates being stored within a tank, like an Abrams tank, where there's all sorts of hot surfaces within a tank. So it's not just storage in regard to, warehousing. It is mm-hmm. how are these ballistic vests and ballistic plates being stored in a non-storage environment. And my experience, as soon as I saw what was happening, and having been involved in these units over the years, I knew exactly what some candidate scenarios were, and this was happening all the time. But the point being is that if you don't want to look for failure, you would never have found this out.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. You know, I'm imagining people cooking with these plates.
Well, they are. They're great little tabletops if you're cooking hot meals out in the middle of the bush. Great little tabletops to rest.
Hot canteens. Yeah, soldiers are very, very creative of using what they have. There's no doubt about that. Anyway, we could go on and on about the uses of military equipment and recipes, if nothing else. But the
soldiers have done make things break over the years.
That's right. And the but you also get very, very creative solutions for real world problems. It goes back and forth. But the I agree with your point, though, is that if you're not looking for the failure and not stepping back and maybe doing a fault tree analysis or doing the chemical analysis or doing the material properties and doing the due diligence to understand why is this happening? What are we seeing here? And I think there's two mistakes that occur in organizations, and it's a management role or leadership role, and it could be the reliability people doing the leadership, that failures are to be expected and they're good. It's our chance to learn something. And then the second part is you got to extract as much information out of that opportunity when it occurs. So yes, failure analysis takes resources. Mm-hmm. And the return on investment is always there. You have to understand the failure. And so I think you think that's a good summary for this one?
Well, we've come across plenty of organizations which have regretted not testing enough. I've yet to come across an organization which regretted testing too much.
Yeah, I would add to that is not learning enough from their failure or learning enough from their testing. Plenty of organizations do a great amount of testing and fool themselves.
That's true.
So I think there's a little, you're still a student here, Chris. Yeah. I got to work on that. Hey, you're getting closer.
Working on it.
Yeah, working closer. So, again,
I'm my teacher.
That's right. So, part of this conversation is in your program, as a listener, and I know we've got all these different programs and different products and different industries, and different constraints that we deal with on a day-to-day basis. One of them is our approach, our attitude towards our testing or evaluations of any failure, wherever it happens. If it's treated as a nuisance and something to be avoided and not talked about, I think you've got work to do as part of what you add value to an organization. If it's celebrated and you extract as much information out of it, you got a good program. And so we'd love to hear from you especially how do you transition an organization from one to another? How did you help make that happen? Success stories, so to speak. And you can let us know and that would be a great candidate to just bring on a guest to the show and talk about how they went about making a transition to an organization that got more out of their failures. But to go over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR, and you can let us know your story. And if you're interested, or even just make a comment or suggestion for another episode in and along these topic lines or others, we'd love to hear from you. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Chris. Talk again soon.
Thanks, Fred.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.